John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Proxima B is the hint of a planet that we can see, travel to, imagine human beings on, 4.5 light years away. TRAPPIST-1 is the imagine, glimpse, project ourselves to a 40 light year out. That's about 12 parsec system with three rocky planets, we believe they could be wet, in the habitable zone of a much smaller star, but in a boutique star, but in any event, we could survive there. So, how do we translate this? So, well, we can go to the Enterprise and we can go to Warp 1, or we can talk about the projects that are now underway to glimpse, to study Proxima B or the TRAPPIST-1 system and travel there. That's right. This is Hotel Mars, Episode N. These ambitions also work for our solar system and work for Mars, and we'll discuss that. David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show, is my colleague and co-host and co-pilot, and we're very privileged to welcome Philip Lubin, professor of physics at the University of California at Santa Barbara, who's here to introduce us to what NASA has been working on for several years, that is the engine, the machinery that would make it possible to travel to Proxima B, or to TRAPPIST-1 system within a lifetime, within several lifetimes, within maybe moments, and might even make it possible to get to Mars for supper. Phil, a very good evening to you. Congratulations, and help us understand the project at NASA that's called Deep In-Directed. Its sidebar is the Directed Energy Interstellar Study. What is Deep In? What is Directed Energy? Good evening to you, Professor.
Good evening. Afternoon my time. It's pleasure to be on your show. The NASA program started from a 2014 proposal that was accepted and then funded in early 2015. Actually, the research began back in 2009, but it took us a while to get this portion funded. The basic idea is that if you want to go very fast, which is what would be required to get to the nearest stars in a human lifetime, which is one of our goals, is to get there not in 1,000 years, but in less than a human lifetime. In order to do so, you have to go very fast. And in order to go very fast, you have to have a propulsion system which is radically different from any propulsion system that we've used to date. And that's the basis for our NASA program. It's on the books. It's called the first one. We're in a phase two. The first phase is called Deep In, DEEP-IN, and the second one's called DEIS, neither of which is particularly memorable. So we now call it Starlight, just to make it easier for people to think about it, because there's a number of variants of a theme on that, as you'll see as we speak. And the basic idea is rather simple. If you take light and use it as the propellant, if you will, then you have an exhaust coming out of the spacecraft, although we don't carry the source of propulsion with us. In this case, we keep the propulsion system back on the Earth, near the Earth, perhaps on the Moon or in orbit around the Earth. And we basically shine an incredibly powerful beam of light on a reflector, which then reflects the light. And that reflection is just like an exhaust. Except the exhaust coming off is coming off at the speed of light. And it's that fact that the exhaust is coming off so fast it allows you to achieve speeds which are close to the speed of light. And that's what's necessary in order to be able to traverse to the nearest stars. Otherwise, you really can't do it. And conventional chemistry doesn't work. When you go down the list of possibilities that humanity has developed, chemistry, ion engines, solar sails, nuclear thermal engines, nuclear fission driven engines, and even hypothetical fusion engines, which will someday be viable. None of those really work very well in terms of getting a mission to the nearest stars in human lifetime. The only two possibilities that we know of are either annihilation engines, which are basically antimatter combined with matter to give you relativistic exhaust and annihilating the matter with the antimatter, or directed energy systems. And we don't know how to produce antimatter in the quantities needed, nor how to store it, nor how to react it with a low enough residual mass. So we're kind of left in a corner with only one viable solution at this point, and that's using directed energy, which has a lot of advantages and some disadvantages, as we'll see.
David?
Hi, Phil. Can you beam brighter light or a more powerful laser beam to it and get faster speeds? Is that how you would increase the speed?
Yeah, this system, unlike conventional propulsion, is not limited in the speed to low speeds. You can propel any mass to any speed up to the speed of light. We don't know how to get to the speed of light or exceed it currently, but you can get as close as you want with a number of caveats. And the caveat is that in order to go faster for a given mass, you have to increase the power or increase the size of the optical elements of the laser array. And it's an array rather than a single laser. It's a very large number of smaller lasers, which is one of the keys to the program. But yeah, there's no reason we couldn't, in theory, get up to 50, 60, 70, you know, 80, 90% the speed of light, which, of course, makes us much more capable in the future. But this is part of a long-term program to develop, you know, a radically new technology to allow us to get to these ultra-high speeds. But it is a development program. I would estimate, even if we went, you know, all out at this point, it would take us a minimum of probably 30 years to fully develop and test the technology needed. It's much like the electronics industry, in that this technology is exponentially growing in capability. Same reason that your cell phone gets better, and while it may not get cheaper, it certainly gets much more capable. And it's the same reason that laptops are now so inexpensive and fast. But photonics, like electronics, is an exponentially growing technology driven largely by the consumer market, as is electronics. So the need for faster data, for high-speed video, for, you know, all of the things that you find so near and dear in your life, the ability to never be without your work or without your internet is what's driving the photonics industry, primarily in the fiber optics domain, but soon to be also in the computational domain, where you have high-speed photonic interfaces in electronic devices in your computer. So all these are the reasons that we can even think about this, is we have a very large industrial base behind us, the photonics industry, driven by the consumer base, and hence performance gets better exponentially, costs drop exponentially, and it has almost the same exponential scaling as electronics, a doubling in capability about every 18 to 20 months, and dropping by a factor of two in price on the same time scale, about every year and a half to 2 years. So those are very favorable places to be if you want to develop a new technology. And that's completely unlike the conventional propulsion technologies, which are not exponentially growing technologies.
Professor, I want to imagine what this system will look like put together. We'll start with the ground, and then we'll go to what the spacecraft looks like. Is there such a thing as a ground-based laser that can do what you want now, or is this what you need 30 years to build?
There is no currently existing device which will do what we want, namely a laser, or in our case, it's a laser array. There is no such device currently. What does exist are the elements of what we want to put together. So let me take you briefly back to an analogy, which I think all of your listeners will understand. I doubt there's very many people listening to this who do not have a multi-core processor somewhere in their life, whether it's in their phone or whether it's in their laptop or their desktop. And probably everybody has at least a dual core or a quad core, and perhaps more cores than that. And that's very much like an analogy to what we're doing. So long ago, we stopped trying to build supercomputers with single cores. We went to multi-core supercomputers. So supercomputers now have upwards of pushing a million processors in them. You can buy a graphics card with 1,000 processors in it for your home computer, but supercomputers that do a climate simulation, for example, or weather prediction, often use you know, 10,000 processors or several hundred thousand processors. So we're all used to that in our everyday lives, at least on a miniature level. What we're not used to is arrays of lasers being synthesized to one equivalent like a supercomputer using many, many modest processors. A laser ray is a large collection of modest laser amplifiers that are synchronized together to produce one, if you want to call it super laser, which we don't call it that, but that might be a language that would be familiar from a supercomputer perspective. And so we're basically parallelizing the process using very modest laser amplifiers, basically 100 watts to 1,000 watts each. They don't need to be very large at all. And the reasons why we don't want them to be too large. The same way that a supercomputer today is made from a large number of consumer-level-like processors, running at typically between 3 and 4 gigahertz, which is the same thing that exists in your desktop or your laptop.
What would this array look like, Phil? Would it be a large scale, acres of like what today we see solar panels laid over acres? Is that what you're imagining?
Yeah, from the sky, it would look something like that. It would look very much like a set of solar panels in the desert, or a set of mirrors for a heliostat,
right,
for a solar thermal system. And there are different ways to make such a system, but in one arrangement, it actually is not dissimilar to looking at a large farm of solar panels. Obviously, very different in functionality, in the sense that it transmits rather than receives, but actually the same system that we would build for transmission to propel the spacecraft out, that which needs to produce a very bright light source to push the spacecraft at high speeds, is used in reverse to receive the data back from the spacecraft. So in that sense, it has some other similarities to a large farm of solar panels, in that we've received the light back from the spacecraft, which is a laser communication system sending data back to
the
Earth.
Just a minute, Professor. We're going to build the spacecraft when we come back with Phil. Philip Lubin is the professor of physics at University of California, Santa Barbara, who's just privileged as heck to be part of Directed Energy Interstellar Study. That's the phase two part of NASA building the engine to get to the stars and to the planets very quickly, with David Livingston, Dr. Space, and The Space Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. John Batchelor, David Livingston, my colleague and friend and co-host, is here, and we're speaking with Philip Lubin, professor of physics, University of California, Santa Barbara, who's part of the NASA project to build a system that can propel probes to the stars, Alpha Centauri, Proxima B, 4.5 light years out, or TRAPPIST-1 at 40 light years out, 12 parsecs, and to the planets as well. We've built the array of lasers that look like a solar panel farm on the Earth. And now what are we directing that energy to? Because that array can also be the receiver from the spacecraft. Phil, the imagining that I've seen for Starshot, which is a private-public organization putting together a lot of hands to waiting for your engine to drive them, is that they're going to send, I think, the number 1,000 probes out from a mothership. Is that something that we can build now, solar sails? That all exists and it's waiting for your engine?
Well, actually, the NASA program is the whole system. It's the combination of the laser array, whether on the ground or in orbit or on the moon, plus the reflector, plus the spacecraft. So it's actually the entire system.
Good.
The Breakthrough Foundation found out about our work, and after we published some of our proceedings from the NASA Phase 1, and then they liked it so much they decided they would like to help support the whole effort. So they've pledged $100 million over roughly a 5 to 10 year period to help do some of the research and development that will not build the system, but it will certainly help us greatly develop it. The program is currently funded by NASA in a phase two, as you mentioned, and we also have another donor. It's a fund known as the Emmett and Gladys W. Technology Fund. So we have several partners already, and this involves starting to involve more and more people. So what is involved? Basically, build a very large laser array, which is nothing but a very bright source of light. Use that light to bounce off a reflector, and by bouncing off a reflector, it's just like throwing a ball against the wall. The ball comes back towards you, and the wall gets pushed away from you. So if you throw a ball at a piece of paper, the piece of paper takes off, the ball doesn't necessarily come back to you, so it's not such a perfect analogy. But the basic idea is very simple. You take light, shine it on a reflector. The reflector moves away from you and can achieve very high speeds if you have a bright enough light source and a large enough array. So the spacecraft itself could be anything. And this is where sometimes people don't really understand the program. The program is not limited to very tiny spacecraft. In our NASA program, we propose using wafer scale spacecraft. For the Breakthrough Starshot program, same thing. We're going to use small wafer scale spacecraft. They're called Starships for Starshot. For the NASA program, which we now call Starlight, we use wafer scale spacecraft. Same thing. But if that's not the only thing you can propel. You could propel a CubeSat-like mission. You could propel, you know, a Voyager-class mission, or you could propel a human-capable spacecraft. You know, something larger than the space shuttle, if you wanted to. It's just that the more massive you are, the slower you go for a given laser array. And so there's a trade-off. If you want to go very fast, choose something very low mass, and wafer-scale spacecraft allow us now the possibility of placing an entire spacecraft with imaging sensors and attitude control systems, small photonic propulsion systems on board, all kinds of things you couldn't have imagined, you know, 10, 20 years ago placing on a wafer, but we now have the technology to place all of that on a wafer. So we have, you know, some interesting possibilities ahead of us to make these extraordinarily low mass and therefore with our system extremely fast spacecraft, which can be sent out unlike missions that we currently send to the moon or to other places in the solar system. Rather than sending one out every year or, you know, every couple of years, we could send out these small spacecraft one every few minutes if we wanted to. It only takes about 3 to 5 minutes at the most to accelerate up the small wafers to 20-30% speed of light.
David, we have about 2 minutes. You want to go ahead?
Is the laser array here on Earth or elsewhere? And what if something gets in between the destination of the laser light and the beam, like a bird or an airplane or something?
Yeah, or atmospheric conditions, Phil. We have about 2 minutes.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, so the laser array does not have to be in any particular place. The Earth would be the logical place to start. It's cheaper to build. We do have to deal with the atmosphere. So the atmosphere is an issue. As we know, stars twinkle. So our beam will also twinkle if we don't do something to adjust the atmosphere conditions. So we monitor the atmosphere and we feed back into the system, much like an adaptive optics system on a telescope. So that's one of our challenges, to mitigate the atmosphere. It could be on the moon or it could be in orbit. There are many possibilities. And if you look in our paper called The Roadmap to Interstellar Flight, you'll see many of those possibilities listed. In terms of things getting in the way, if it is on the ground, we do worry about birds. We worry about aircraft and spacecraft, of course, you know, satellites that might be in the way. And so we have to take all those into account. We have to have a system that monitors what's in the air, whether it's spacecraft, airplane, or bird, and then takes the appropriate actions, such as not turning on during that time. So we want to be very careful not to harm birds, not to turn them into something that they wouldn't want to be.
Professor, did I hear you say 30, 40, 50, up to 90% the speed of light? Is that capable? Are we capable of that?
Well, think of it this way. When you turn on a flashlight, what comes out of the flashlight are particles, what we call them photons, and they're moving at the speed of light.
Right.
What happens as you increase the mass from zero, which is the mass of a photon, to something which is not zero, is they slow down from the speed of light to something lesser, and the heavier the object you're pushing, the more massive it is, the slower you go. So there's no particular limit up to the speed of light. If you increase the power level, you can get arbitrarily close to the speed of light for any given mass. What we're shooting for at the moment is to shoot wafer scale things, which are, you know, roughly the size of your hand or, you know, like a ball size, up to about 20-30% the speed of light. That's what the goals of our NASA program and the Breakthrough Starship program.
I'll take it. Professor Philip Lubin, Professor of Physics, University of California, Santa Barbara. The NASA program is Directed Energy Interstellar Study. It's a study on the NASA site. You can read. There's lots of material here. This is within your lifetime, young people, your lifetime. Phil and his colleagues can get there. David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show. This is Hotel Mars. I think Mars takes about 40 minutes at this added half the speed of light. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.